Welcome to Will Work for Purpose. Today I'm joined by Paul Vanderclay, who is a pastor of the Christian Reformed Church. And he has a YouTube channel called Paul Vanderclay, where he talks, where he has been talking with at least one person every day for several years now. And these conversations that he has, they're long format, and they cover a variety of issues and topics underneath religion, philosophy, theology, politics. And then some of them are just sort of more personal, sort of like story sharing sessions. And he's been able to do this rather successfully and talk with people who have contentious viewpoints and people whom he disagrees with and people who disagree with him. And he's been able to do this in a very sort of amicable, very kind-hearted way, in which it seems that there's no mean spirits between either conversationalist. And so that's kind of the theme of my episode here with him today. We talk a little bit about how can you have these types of conversations given the charged nature that we find ourselves in, what with the political system flaring up and people just sort of being at an all-time high when it comes to outrage in terms of their, you know, talking about various hot button issues. So without further ado, here is the 19th episode with Paul Vanderclay. And it's a little bit long, but if you stick through it, I think you'll find something valuable. So I guess I kind of wanted to talk to you today because I've been diving deep in terms of like I found the Randos United channel and started listening to a lot of those conversations as a byproduct maybe of your conversation with Nathan, a digital Gnosis guy that you had on. When I listened to your conversation with Nathan, I couldn't figure out like how you guys got connected, and I saw his YouTube channel and I listened to his video where he was talking about you, and I thought, wow, you know, they were talking so amicably on Paul's channel. I didn't know that he was, you know, lambasting you on his channel or whatever, you know, like, and that's, you know, like kind of like I didn't know that he had views contrary to you when I first listened to him. Essentially, I've seen a lot of like maybe somewhat people who don't share your views per se come on your channel, and you, I've never seen you not have an amicable conversation, basically. And so I was kind of just curious and wanted to ask you a few questions, especially as, you know, we're in times now where people are the least amicable they've ever been, maybe, or the least charitable in terms of conversation, maybe. Or maybe that's just the people that I've experienced in my own social circles, but it seems that we're in sort of like contentious times, let's say. Like, you know, because I have a pretty radically conservative and socially conservative family who, you know, like in the events of like the Capitol Hill sort of that whole business there, are still sort of like up in arms about everything in terms of like they're on the side of the people who stormed the Capitol and, you know, all that. And so it's just, you know, your style is interesting to me in the sense that like you seem to be able to disarm even people who disagree with you, you know?
Well, I think part of it is the medium. When we're talking about people, it's a lot easier to be dismissive, contentious, contemptible than when we're talking to people, especially if we have the cameras on. And so part of the thing that I did on the Discord server is I've sort of been trying to create a culture where people turn the cameras on, because you do. We have these mirror neurons, and if I say something that hurts you, I have to see, and I see the pain on your face, I feel some of that pain. One of the things I did fairly early on with our church, because this church had a long history of contention and turmoil And often those bad events which tore at the fabric of the church happened at congregational meetings. And the way congregational meetings usually work is that everybody sits in the rows like they do in church, and they all face forward. So then they stand up and they say ugly things at the back of people's faces. And so if I knew we were going to have a difficult congregational meeting, I first did was make a whole bunch of circles in the sanctuary and say, before we have a vote or anything like this to have discuss this topic, I want to break you up into groups of 6 or 8 or 10. And I want you guys to talk about this. And then I might seed, you know, people of the opposing parties in. So let's start our conversation about this contentious issue face to face in small groups. Nobody has a microphone. Nobody's going to grandstand. If you want to say something ugly about the ideas or the person of, with whom you share a church, you need to say it to their face in front of other people around. And you better believe in most cases, people will be a little bit more generous, be a little bit more understanding, and be more ready to compromise. And I don't think it's a, and many other people have made this point, it's not a mystery that we have been having these contentious political times at the same time that we're having COVID lockdowns where people can't be with family of the opposite political party. And it's part of the reason also on my channel, I spend a lot of time, way more time than anybody else I know. If I'm going to have a substantive conversation with someone who thinks differently about something as important as religion, I want to first have, especially them, talk about their background. I'm happy to answer questions about my background, and I'm happy to do disclosure on that, but I want people to tell their story. And after they tell their story, it's a little bit easier to understand how they arrived at the opinions and conclusions they have, and to respect them, and probably to engage more productively in debating the things that are debated. You know, I look at our political realm right now, and do we want more poverty or less? Everyone will say less poverty.
Right, right.
Do we want more fairness or less? Everyone will say more fairness. Mm-hmm. Now, the questions we have is how to have less poverty, how to have better health care, how to have more fairness. So those, you know, you're going to have lots of legitimate disagreements on the how to, but maybe we can start with, let's begin with what we agree on. Okay, less poverty, more fairness, less racism. Let's start there. So if we can agree on that, but if you say, no, you don't really care about racism. Well, first of all, how do you know that? How do you know what I do and don't care about? How well do you really know me? So again, so much of this is just let's up our capacity for trust by seeing each other in ways that we can see commonality. So that's a lot of it. And then the real trick is to not be reactive. That's the real trick. Because if to not be reactive and to be able and willing to absorb pain, it's relatively easy to inflict pain. It's much more difficult to absorb pain. So let them insult you. Let them say all kinds of mean things about you. And you say, well, where'd you get an idea? Well, how about the Sermon on the Mount? It's right there. Blessed are you when people insult you and say all kinds of evil things about you. That's what Jesus says. So shouldn't Jesus' followers count it as blessings when people insult them? It's really hard to learn how to do, but it's right there in the Bible.
Yeah, you know, I had a conversation which I'm going to upload soon with, I talked with Julian, he's like frequents the Randos United channel, and he's a Hutterite, and it was really interesting because we talked a lot about that, and this is going to be sort of a subsequent question, like how much does your sort of Christian ethos sort of impact or affect your ability to converse with people? Because, you know, we kind of came to that a similar conclusion in our conversation where it was sort of like one of the central tenets of Christianity is to be struck without striking back or something like that, you know. And so it's sort of like that's what informs my ability to talk with anybody, is it's sort of like that humanizing, kind of what you described, and having people share their stories. You know, like I totally agree with you in the sense that it's important to sort of contextualize beliefs and arguments within someone's life, you know, like, because you're exactly right. We agree on a lot of the fundamental things, you know, like let's stop racism, let's feed the, you know, feed the hungry, in poverty, that kind of thing. It kind of reminds me of like what was something like, it was in like a Jordan Peterson lecture where he said something like, people go out and protest like against poverty. And it's like, you know, that's like, what do you mean? Like everybody's against poverty. Like that's not really a controversy, that, you know, that's not something you really need to protest for or whatever, you know, like, but yeah, the sort of specifics, yeah, is where everybody, you know, that's where people come to blows in a lot of ways. Let me think for a second. So this kind of also feeds into it, because I've also started kind of reading a lot of what James Lindsay has been putting out with that new discourses business about sort of the wokeness and sort of like, you know, all that he rails against in critical race theory and things like that. And I watched this one conversation which they were talking about sort of like protesting tactics. And the idea is that one of the tactics is to bring people to a decision dilemma or something, or dilemma decision, where, you know, you kind of get in their face and you yell at them and you make them react to you. And so I guess whenever, I mean, have you ever had people meet you that hostily with your views? I almost find it, I almost can't believe that someone would yell at you. Like,
people yell at me.
Do you literally just not react? Like, are you a stone in some sense? Like, do you just have a flat affect, or do you kind of address their sort of behavior towards you? Like some psychologists call it, you're tethering yourself to the here and now, which is not something that typically happens in like one-on-one relation, you know, with good friends. You don't typically point out in the moment when something is happening, you know,
right?
Whereas like that's sort of like a big bit in therapy where, you know, the idea is that your pathology will sort of make itself manifest in any one-on-one interaction, and the therapist is to point it out in the here and now. And so like, do you do that? Do you just say, look, you know, like how do you sort of handle that in the moment?
I don't always get it right. Let me say that first. Mm-hmm. And I have plenty of experience trading, you know, mm-hmm. debating people on things. I've got plenty of experience and I still do that. A lot depends on the context, on the relationship. You know, the place, if someone really wants to learn how to do this, the place to start is at home with the people that you share a dwelling with. It might be a spouse, it might be your children, it might be your parents, because those are the arguments that are so common and often very petty. And one of the things that you might learn in a case like that is winning the fight doesn't necessarily help, because what you really want is, you know, are you really annoyed that they're not doing their share around the house in terms of, you know, maybe taking their turn cleaning the kitchen? But the bigger things that you want are a degree of commonality and allegiance. And do we want a clean kitchen or not? Yes. Okay. What are we both willing to do to have a clean kitchen? Well, maybe your standards of cleanliness are not where mine are. Okay. Well, then we're going to have to do some negotiation. But what happens within us is that, no, see, this gets into one's Christian belief too, because if you believe that everything in the world is riding now on this political victory, which has now sort of been mediated down into this verbal exchange between me and you about some political point, Yeah, you're going to fight like your life depends on it. Well, what if your life doesn't depend on it? What if your life is hidden with Christ in the heavenlies and preserved by him and will be revealed at the time of his appearance? Well, then now I can lose this fight because, and in almost every case in terms of political argument, I find people arguing about things that they have absolutely no control over. Well, I think the tax rate mm-hmm. should be higher. Well, I think minimum wage should be $15. Okay, mm-hmm. so you think that. Are you setting the minimum wage? I mean, even if you're a member of Congress, you've got to kind of do it all within your other people. And so mm-hmm. what we're participating in is something a fair ways from who's actually making the decisions. So we get caught up in sort of a participatory spirit. And all of that psychology is very reasonable and very well known. We want to be good, loyal tribesmen and women, and that's a good thing. We should be loyal to our tribes. But in almost every case, the little spat you're having on Facebook or Twitter, there's no point to it. You know, and then if you say, well, if I really want to convince my political adversary of my point, what does it actually take to influence people? Well, that takes, and again, this is not mysterious. That takes trust. That takes regard. So it's actually a very effective strategy of influence to build trust with your enemy. Because if they can trust you, at least for maybe not for everything, they might not trust your ideas, they might not trust your perspective, but if at least they can trust your good faith. Well, how do they trust your good faith? Why don't you ask them about how their day has gone? If you know that they have a sick child, ask them if their child is feeling better today. I don't want to say that they're tricks. We all know this about each other. And so build the relationship that affords the trust that eventually affords more difficult and productive conversations. None of this is rocket science. And there's a degree of mob possession. It's a sort of demonic possession that takes over people. And social media and, you know, so lately, my kids have been watching Ink Master. And so we've been watching episodes of Ink Master where it's this tattooing contest. You know, all those reality shows are the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so much, you know, so, and we kind of watch it because it's, I don't have any tattoos. I intend to never get a tattoo, but I'm pretty amazed at what they can do with tattoos in terms of the art. It's pretty impressive.
It is out there for sure. Yeah.
But how much of that silly show aren't those people bickering with each other in the house? And for psychological reasons, we're all drawn to that. And it's an attention economy. So if we have AI algorithms that are optimized for attention, all of those algorithms are going to heighten conflict. And so, you know, we're worried about robots getting machine guns to kill us in the street. Well, maybe some of our AI is already, you know, mm-hmm. They're not bothering with machine guns. They're just weaponizing us to kill each other. Mm-hmm. And the AI is doing that mm-hmm. in some ways, if that's what you set your AI to do. And I see it as, you know, making, watching on YouTube, it isn't rocket science to figure out how to get a YouTube following or a following on Twitter. Push people's buttons, because people both like to push buttons, and a little part of them likes to have their buttons pushed because they have the hope they're going to be able to push the other buttons harder. And so just ramp that stuff up and you will gain a following. But okay, you've gained a following. Are you burning down the world? So again, none of this is new. We all know this, and we all say we know this.
Right. Yeah.
Why can't we stop?
Yeah, you know, it seems like there's just a lot of like dissonance and disconnect, you know, from you talk with people, you know, who for all intents, like, so if I have a disagreement with someone, like it may, like I virtually never, at least in my personal life, I would never have that spat online. You know, like for instance, my sisters like to get a rise out of my mom. At least one of my sisters is super like far left leaning in some sense, you know, and my mom is like, you know, she's in a right wing bunker to a certain degree, you know, and my younger sister has loads and loads and loads and loads of friends. And my mom is kind of naive when it comes to social media in the sense that she'll get on there and start to argue with my sister on one of her forum posts or one of her posts. And like, it just like, everybody just starts to sort of like pick her feathers in some sense, you know, like they just,
kinda,
you know, like,
that's
yeah,
right.
You know, like, you know, like, and she's really not like, you know, I know my mother, she's not as, like, she's not as bad as she can be set up to be in an online presence, you know, like, so, you know, and then everybody gets this horrible image of everything. And so like, you know, stuff like that, like, I you know, and there's sort of like, well, it's exactly like what you're saying in terms of the what'd you say, like the attention-driven economy and how conflict sort of drives views, drives likes, drives shares, all that. Like, the contentious view is the one that wins the day in a lot of ways. And there's this subtle meme that kind of runs around where it's sort of like, if I see 50 comments on a Facebook post, I'm going to read them no matter what because there's an argument there, you know. And so it's sort of like, you know, it almost feels a little bit like, I wouldn't call it biological warfare, but more like social warfare, sociological warfare, but like carried out on such a benign level that people don't even really realize how in some sense they're being programmed, like you're saying, by these algorithms, you know,
it's
to be shown.
It's not benign. It's benign. And we're seeing that now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess that's true. You know, like it was, I would say seemingly benign. Like there are some things that like you wouldn't realize how, you know, how much they can sort of take stock in your soul, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, you know, like how much they control your seat of emotions, you know, your heart, you know, like, and so there are a lot of like popular level people who win this following because they're contentious in one way or another. Or they just have a blatant disregard and disrespect for people in general, you know, like with that whole pranking culture that kind of arose, you know, over the past 10 years or so, where so much so that there was a scandal there was one popular YouTuber named Logan Paul, and he went into this suicide forest and was like videotaping, you know, things that you obviously shouldn't videotape. But the thing is that he got to such a point that he thought it would be okay to do that, you know, type of radical prank, you know? And I wonder, like, I was thinking about this in terms of like the sort of the degradation of our society's morals in general and our lack of sort of ability to orient yourself in sort of a meaningful and, I guess, let's say transcendent way. I think, because we saw it early on in the summer with like that movie Cuties that came out, that was, you know, bad for a number of horrible reasons. But the thing is that like the media team at Netflix, such a large corporation, thought it would be okay to release something like that to the society at large, like one of the most used streaming services, you know. And so the fact that such a large corporation and all their media consultants likely thought, oh yeah, this is a good idea, like, to me points to a significant breakdown in our like moral framework as a society. And I think that, you know, like you're saying with this programming by contentious, you know, media, whether it's Twitter fights, everybody gets into a tweet storm at, you know, like, you know, even like just over potentially anything, you know, like I saw everybody was up in arms about J.K. Rowling's new Harry Potter thing, a live action Harry Potter show. And, you know, everybody's boycotting her and really upset with her because of her views towards trans people. And, I wonder, I guess, where... Do you see it only sort of, I can only think of it in terms that basically I only see things getting worse, you know, like I only see more and more of this happening, more and more sort of you know, contentious arguments breaking out, more and more division, less and less humanity, you know, especially with like, you know, more screen time due to COVID, like that drove everything up. And you're right, it did create a perfect storm for the Capitol Hill event. But is there, do you think, and I kind of watched some of your thing today about the church sort of, what would you say, you know, not in some sense being fundamentally changed due to COVID, you know, whether people will return to in person or they'll stay in Zoom, or, you know, how COVID kind of permanently changed that sort of church landscape. Do you think that in some sense, like we'll only drift further away from each other, or like there's some, there could be some potential sort of maybe unifying movement, or that maybe you see a different trend than I do?
Well, history is really funny. But there is sort of a, there's sort of a, think about fights in your household, say between your sister and your mom. Mm. They'll have a big fight and it'll go bad and they'll say things. And then after it all quiets down, you know, your mind goes back over it and you think, she's my mom. You know, yeah, okay, maybe she watches Fox all the time. Maybe she mm-hmm. loves Donald Trump too much, but she's still my mom.
Right.
You know, and yeah, I'd love to change her politically. And in many cases, things will get bad and then people will come back from it. And, you know, they'll go back and forth and back and forth. And this happens on larger scales too. So every now and then things sort of, you know, go overboard and you'll mm-hmm. have a civil war and you'll have things will fall apart sometimes, but they don't always fall apart. And so then the question we ask is, are things going to fall apart now? And we can't say, you know, if you look at, let's say, American history in the 19th century before the Civil War, I mean, tensions rise and then they'd go back and forth, you know, the compromise of 1850, and you just go back and forth until it gets really dangerous when you hit an impasse. And then, but then after the war, then, you know, you tend to settle back down again. And in terms of nations, these things take longer times and sometimes things are lost, lives are lost, but, you know, how's it going to happen in our country? I don't know. I am concerned about the fact that these algorithms are accentuating this, and this isn't unknown. Jonathan Haidt made this point with respect to social media and suicide of girls. Mm. And, you know, basically because when boys fight, generally speaking, it's physical. But if you have a couple of teenagers using fists, if they're just using fists, you'll get some bloody nose and you'll get some hurt feelings, but they're not, you know, as long as they aren't knives and guns, they'll find a way to make peace. Mm-hmm. But girls are fighting reputationally. Mm-hmm. And like you described the pile on, mm-hmm. now, you know, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. No, words, because we are at least 50% and probably more non-physical beings. And so those relational things, especially for girls and women, those relational things really matter. And so you will get breakups and breakdowns, and you will get people who can't talk to a son or a parent, a daughter or a mother for generations. But there's enough in the culture, there's a lot of things that go into that. And usually, okay, What are the other structures around them? Will they have a mutual friend that will say, hey, she's your mom. You know, when you were a little girl and you got sick and, you know, you puked in your bed and she came up and cleaned up and comforted you, you didn't ask her who she voted for. She loves you. And, you know, same thing. She's your daughter. You know, you invested years of your life. You sacrificed, you know, how many hours and how much money into her well-being. And, you know, all you really want is to have this silly political thing end in an embrace. And 10 years from now, you're not going to feel about Donald Trump what you feel now on either side. Right. So, and so then there are other people in the life that will say, hey, okay, you don't like her politics. You know what? It's a vote. All right. What you two have is way more important than the vote. And so stop the insanity and make up. And most of the time that will prevail. But the problem is, see, that's why it isn't just the conflict. It's all, it's the matrix of relationships and institutions and practices and memories. It's all of those containers that we slowly build throughout our life that those things then really matter.
Yeah. I totally agree. Oh, my dog just tried to, this is like a false wall basically behind me, like an accordion wall. She likes to bust through sometimes, like the Kool-Aid man.
Fine. The dog can join the podcast.
Yeah. I understand exactly what you're talking about because early on in like, I initially became a Christian and then I fell into this sort of like typical apologetics phase where I was reading all these books and like I had the canned arguments for God's existence, you know, whatever that, you know, ontological, cosmological, calm, like all those, you know, like the standard arguments you hear running around, in apologetics communities today. And I wanted to become like a logic chopper, basically. Like I wanted to, you know, I took a logic class. Like I was like, I wanted to be able to do this thing to people where I could argue with them and I could just, you know, as they brought objections, I could just stomp them out systematically, you know? And I thought that would be the way, you know, I thought that would be the way to convert people to my, like to make them think like me in some sense, you know? And, I thought that was like, that was really important. And I thought that would be really useful to do. And I also thought that people thought that way. I thought, you know, never mind that I wasn't really converted by logical arguments or anything like that. And in fact, if at the time, you know, someone came to me with that sort of line of conversation, I'd be like, oh, buddy, like, I don't really, you know, like, I get you're zealous about this, but, you know, it's not really, you know, my cup of tea or whatever. And I got so much so into that camp that, you know, so much so into logic chopping, so much so into these systematic arguments for God's existence that I remember I was talking with one of the guys I lived with, and this was close to my conversion because I was still living with everybody that I lived with. They were like strident atheists, you know, like they didn't believe, like, and it was weird to them that I did start believing in this thing and start going to church instead of, you know, staying up and doing whatever, I was talking with him. I was arguing with him about the existence of a soul, which one, we were just driving back from Taco Bell. So the conversation wasn't at all like that, but that was just how my mind went. Like sure. There was dead air. I would just start to talk about these arguments basically. Yeah. It got to such a point that we were driving through the subdivision and he opened the door and got out of the moving car to get away from me. And, we were going like 20, 25 miles an hour and he literally rolled on the ground to get away from and walked home. And, you know, at that time I still didn't quite have the force or I didn't really have the insight rather to recognize like, oh, you know, I should change my tactics up. Like I shouldn't talk like this to people. Basically I shouldn't, you know, the general public, they don't really, you know, in the people in your lives, they don't really want you to do that basically, you know, like they don't, and nor would they be convinced otherwise, you know. It wasn't really until maybe about a year later where I was arguing with someone, we were texting. Cause, you know, like that was how, like, that was just how we communicated. And so, because he was in the military and, we went through all these, like a lot of these arguments and then finally just like stopped responding to me for a long time. And it was like that one where I was like, okay, I'm not doing this right. You know, like I'm not trying to convince people the right way basically. And so now, you know, that was 3 years ago or so. And so like now I'm considerably different in my tact and approach and how I even convince people. But it was that exactly how you're describing, that sort of like thinking back. Like it did take a while because I'm pretty dense, you know, but it took a while. But eventually that sort of remorse sort of kicked in and was like, you know, okay, maybe it's not the case that, you know, I'm in the right all the time in terms of these conversations. And in some sense, I had this undergirding principle too, which I see a lot in Christian circles, because I used to talk with this one guy who was a young earth creationist, and he was, man, he did not like me very much in whenever we had these conversations, you know. And he, you know, he said, like, we dealt amicably with each other in terms of, like, we weren't mean spirited about it, but he would always cite times at which people were, you know, very visibly upset with him, you know. And he tied it back to the idea that in some sense it's good to be hated for Christ's sake, or that, you know, Christians in general will be hated to some capacity. And what I saw in him was not that he was being hated for his, you know, Christianness, but rather for his unchristianness, you know, like for his sort of like brutal assertion of, you know, what he thought to be the science of the time, and like the stuff like that, you know, like it was just very bullheaded, very like uncharitable, you know, just like if I said anything contrary to the doctrines he was espousing, it was almost as if I was an un-Christian, like not just that I was not a Christian, but that I was doing something fundamentally worse than not being a Christian, as in tainting, you know, sacred, you know, the sacred doctrine of creation, things like that, you know. So I wonder, you know, like, I think we, like, now my Christian belief informs me in a different way in some sense, you know, like the idea that I should be struck without striking back, you know. So like if someone gets upset with me and calls me a name, it's like I'm under oath to not do that to them, you know. But in the same way that my Christian belief informs me to do that, and your Christian belief informs you to do that, like this guy's Christian belief informed him to be this sort of monster, and you know. And so I guess I'm trying to think of the way to form the question, because I rambled for a bit there, but I think maybe how do you sort of handle someone that has sort of like this sort of transcendent ethic that they think that they're almost ordained by God to upset people, you know?
It's not different from the other kind of examples we were talking about.
Yeah.
You know, it's very interesting how, you know, there's all kinds of questions that one might ask in this realm. If logic chopping apologetics was the primary vehicle God would use to achieve his goals, why isn't there more of it in the Bible? If the Bible doesn't look that way, you know, what is the Bible full of? You know, Christians, you know, you've got Christians out there that are making all of these arguments why the Bible is the inspired and errant word of God, and almost everything that they're you know, sending out there looks nothing like what they said God sent out there. And that must just cause you to pause for a moment and, you know, look at, okay, so you're arguing that Jesus is the ultimate revelation of God. Good. Okay. What does that ultimate revelation look like? How does that ultimate revelation talk? What does that ultimate revelation do? You know, Jesus, and I often go back to the first chapter of the book of Acts. Jesus says, that after the crucifixion, after the resurrection, after they've seen him eat a fish, Jesus' disciples say, "Now will you restore the kingdom to Israel?" Now, that tells us a lot about what was on the disciples' mind. And if you read the, if you read the Old Testament, if you read the prophets, it's not, if you know something about the Second Temple period, it's not hard to understand what the disciples wanted from Jesus. And then if you look at Jesus and you listen to him, you'll notice that even at this point, the disciples really don't have much of a clue about what Jesus had been doing. Now, that they're going to get a better clue when you get to Acts 2 and the coming of the Holy Spirit, but what does that mean? And of course, all of these gospel accounts are written, you know, a little while after the fact, after one way or another, the church sort of has an idea together. They've got plenty of division, you know, circumcision, no circumcision, meat sacrifice to idols, you know, sleeping with prostitutes. I mean, all of these, they got lots of questions. They got lots of divisions. They're rife with conflict. I mean, you can't read the New Testament closely and not see there's tremendous conflict going on around this emergent Christianity that is coming to be. But Jesus, if you read the testimony of him in the Bible, in the four Gospels, and, you know, other places in Paul too, Jesus is astoundingly, you know, what we would call in psychological terms today, differentiated. And it isn't the case that Jesus is a floor mat. No, Jesus is sometimes very much not nice. You know, Jesus will say things to people that most pastors would never say. But Jesus is, you know, Jesus in all of this is bearing witness to something. And then when you come to Acts 1, Jesus says to them, "You will be my witnesses." Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, I love the frankness at the end of the book of Acts when Paul's been going up and down and up and down, and he sort of, you know, he goes to Jerusalem and they want to kill him. And so he gets himself arrested so that he won't be killed. And, you know, then there's going to be a plot to take his life. And so then, you know, word gets out. And so where Jesus was killed by Roman soldiers, now Paul is being protected by Roman soldiers. And then Paul goes to Festus and Paul decides he's going to make a play. He's going to make an evangelistic play. And Festus says, "Come on, are you trying to convert me now?" And this is right in the book of Acts. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's this kind of honesty that we see in the New Testament about, and Paul's like, "Hey, you know, I took my shot." But slowly, 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 generation after generation after generation, this thing builds. And so, if we are such short-sighted creatures that we think, you know, okay, I'm going to do all of this converting right now with people. Now, in my tradition, which is, you know, more Calvinism, I don't convert people. The Holy Spirit does that. I, as Paul says, I play a part. Maybe I plant a seed. Maybe I water that seed. Maybe I do a little something. What I want usually in sort of a tribal interchange is I want to, you know, it's like the World War II fighters where, you know, I want to put a swastika on the side of my plane to show how many Germans I shot down. Mm-hmm. No, this is not about me. This in some ways isn't even about you. This is all about Christ and his mission. So I'm not going to be anxious with you. And I, you know, when I first started making YouTube videos, I would get emails and comments regularly. Most of these people sort of gave up on my channel, I think, where someone would write me an email after I'd have a conversation with someone who wasn't a Christian. And they'd say, "You didn't present the gospel to him. What if he dies tonight?" Mm. And it's like, I think actually I was being Christ's witness. And I also believe that God is in the heavens. And I have a very strong sense of providence. And I believe in the power of the Holy Spirit. And I believe in God's sovereign decisions over our world and over our lives. And it's my job to be a witness. That is my job. And sometimes that might involve logical argumentations. And if people want to talk that way, I'm happy to have a debate with them. Very pleased. It's fun. But I'm under no preconceptions that at the end of it, they'll say, you know what? I believe God is real and I'm going to be a Christian right now. Now, I've seen that happen, but most of the time it happens in the pastor's study and a lot of stuff has happened before it. And they don't have a YouTube channel, which is all about debunking the other tribe. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I can play that game. That game is fun to play. I like playing that game, but that game is just in that little box. And what I really care about is I'm to be his witness. And what will, again, we see it all the time. Just read biographies of Christian people in past centuries. There's a little book I have of conversion stories. Almost every case, you know, it's something that happened over here and something my father said and something over here. And that's why we say the Holy Spirit converts people, because it's not usually just one person. So I don't know why Christians suddenly have gotten so dumb. Well, although the disciples weren't real bright. So it's all in the book. Why don't we read it? And why don't we do it?
Man, that what you've said is, you know, resonates a lot with me. And a former version of myself would be in total revolt, because I was, you know, that idea that, you know, that it's this little thing over here, that it's what your dad said or what your, you know, what your mom said to you or what the pastor says and the study after many sessions, things like that. Like, I did not, you know, I was almost like, the only word that's coming to mind is like colonized by this online sort of, you know, we'll bring it back into that conflict algorithm in some sense, you know, like all the videos debunk this, debunk that, you know, destroy this, destroy that, you know, logic and facts and reason and intelligence and, you know, things like that, you know. And it's like, I think the amount of time that I spent online watching things like that, reading things like that, you know, just being entrenched in communities that center around, you know, behavior like that, it sort of gave me a false understanding of how people form their beliefs and how conversation is really meant to function and, you know, things like that. And so it definitely turned me into more of a blight on the world rather than a light on the world. And so I wonder how much, I basically am always trying to think of how to sort of disarm people, like point swords down and things like that. Like, so like if I had, like, recently I had a dinner with all my family, and like I would say 90% of them are still, you know, the election is a fraud, like up in arms about this. Yeah, and like, yeah. some of them are, you know, there was one family gathering where it was almost like, I don't know. It was almost like, basically someone literally stood up and pointed at the only person who didn't, I won't say the only person, but the only person who vocally did not support Trump at the dinner. Yeah. And was like, tell me right now why you think this and this about, yeah, you know, why you think this tax, why, you know, all that, like as if she had to answer for, you know, all of this, you know, as if one, her opinion even really played an important role in the fabric of like, of our political system. You know, it was almost as if her mere existence upset them for some reason, yeah, you know. And
it's helpful in moments like that to ask yourself, we're talking politics and we're talking tax policy and we're talking all these other things. What do people around this table, what are they really looking for? Well, they're probably looking to be respected. They're probably looking to be loved. They're probably looking to be reassured. Now, the avenue by which we're trying to find these things is, it's taken on a certain form, and it's a political debate about Donald Trump and tax policy and whatnot. And I think the best, I think if you want to, I mean, actually, in many ways, those are opportunities to practice some of this. And so try practicing being honest. So when maybe they make a point that you disagree with, agree with that point. Say, you know, that's a really good point, and I'm going to have to think more about that. And when you show that willingness to be influenced, they will probably reciprocate by finding ways to be influenced. And don't pick the most gnarly, hardest thing that would humiliate them. Mm-hmm. Find a point that's sort of in the gray area between you and say, well, what about this point? You know, again, if the more you know about the political debates, the better you can do with this. And then I often simply point to, you know, I just saw that. So Trump, Trump took off all of the travel restrictions right before he left office. Mm-hmm. Biden put them on and put one on South Africa. Mm-hmm. And I think if Trump had put a travel restriction on South Africa, we would have heard the charge of racism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think, you know, it's, well, I know what's in Donald Trump's heart. Do you really? Because my guess is you don't. I guess is you have a picture. Maybe you're right. Maybe you're wrong. But did Joe Biden put a travel restriction on South Africa because of racism? Because he doesn't like black people? Or maybe a travel restriction on that South Africa because they had a history of apartheid. I mean, the problem with almost all of these things is that people are assuming and implying one criteria of relevance when, if you know just a little bit more, and if you remember just a little bit more history, you can sometimes, just in the form of a question, post a question which will begin to sort of undo that assumption, which is really a presumption. And don't do it like a jerk. Just do it gently. And just make it once and then back off of it. Again, it's all stuff that you learn in dealing with people when they're upset. I walked into the supermarket one day and there was a guy, and he was a homeless guy, and he had, you know, I don't exactly, oh, he was just a little bit short of money. And, you know, because he was a homeless guy, they had kind of, the security guard was coming around him, and the situation was just escalating. Mm-hmm. I've got a lot of experience with homeless people. And so I just kind of, but I could just read the checkout girl didn't want a confrontation. The security guard didn't want to tackle this homeless guy. The store manager didn't want a problem, but they all got themselves in a place where the homeless guy had his, you know, oh, it was because the homeless guy had his bike in the store.
Mm.
The homeless guy didn't want to lose his bike.
Right.
And he was short. He was like short 4 cents. And the guy behind him in line, you know, he didn't want to have his day. You know, this could have gone wrong in how many different ways. And all I did was I stepped in. I had a very calm demeanor. I looked at the homeless guy. I engaged him in a gracious way. I said, "Would you like me to hold your bike for you while we figure this out?" And, you know, everyone wanted to de-escalate.
Mm-hmm.
And so he looked at me and he saw the chance at de-escalating and he said, yes. And so I looked at the security guard. Would it be okay if I just held his bike right here while we resolve this? He wanted to de-escalate. Yes. And then, you know, the guy behind him in line said, here's, you know, the extra 25 cents so we can cover his beer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so, okay, the store was satisfied. The bill was fully paid. He got his beer. I walked him out with the bike, gave him his bike. Everybody's day went on, and that situation could have gone all kinds of bad for no good reason, where cops could be called, altercation, restraining order. And so it's just like, chances are in that room, they want to make peace with their family member who's on the opposite political side. Look at the situation. Understand the goal, find a way, if this happens again and again and again and again online in households around the country, over dinner, in marriages, politically we'll all be happier. And now just doing that at Little Bel Air Market just on Florin Road means nothing. But what did I do right there? Now the checkout girl remembers what I did. The security guard remembers what I did. The guy behind in line remembers what I did. And now they've all got a script for the next time something like this happens. Let's just de-escalate this, okay? We're talking 4 cents, an alcoholic, a bike, and a beer.
Yeah, you know, there are a couple big points that I thought of while you were talking, you know, like that idea, de-escalation. Like, I totally agree in some sense that they're like, everyone there definitely wanted de-escalation. I can imagine that some people maybe my age or younger would have got their smartphones out and maybe wanted escalation, or at least they didn't want, they want their 15 seconds of fame or however long, you know, they want their TikTok of some guy throwing his bike over the counter and smashing it, you know, 12 pack on the ground or whatever. Like, that's what they want sometimes, you know, like, you know, and like, I try to have that sort of positive view that people generally want peace. People generally want de-escalation, but this sort of Gen Z, you know, Zoomers, you know, even younger millennials, like, in some sense, what I see is that they want chaos in a lot of ways, you know, like, they don't have anything to really, you know, how did I hear it put once? They're sort of like, a lot of generations sort of, there was a lot of things to rebel against, basically, and the newest generation has the least to rebel against, you know, and so they sort of like, and so they basically rebel against everything, you know, and it just comes out as incoherent screeching to some degree, you know, like, we want progress. Where do we want it? Nowhere. Where do, you know, like, it's like that kind of thing, you know, like, it's a lot of like this sort of like cyclical self-defeating sort of thing. But the thing that I think that was like what you said was really important is that idea of developing scripts for other people in that sense, where you were able to be that archetype or that exemplar figure that they can now model future behavior after. And to me, that resonates deeply because, well, you know, I grew up with a social disorder, and to some degree, I still am affected by it. And for me, having scripts, you know, a script, that's very important. Like, it makes it so much easier for me to talk if I have a script. Like, I couldn't order food. Like, even I frequently ask my wife, how should I say this? Like, I want to hang out with this guy for dinner, but like, how do I ask that? You know, like, things like that. Or like, how do I, or like, if I want an extra set of silverware, like, I literally have to have scripts in my mind, like a sets of phrase, like phraseology that I can use in circumstances which for me I'm better now, obviously, but typically before, you know, like, I couldn't interact or engage in any of those avenues if I did not have a pre-assembled script, you know. So like, and I think that there's, you know, we've lost our scripts for our moral code to some degree, like our ability to step in and intervene in a situation like that. Like, it takes particular moral characters to be able to do something like that. You know, like, most people don't have scripts for, you know, de-escalating domestic abuse on the street, or, you know, things like that. Like, that's atypical behavior. You know, like, most people, what do you hear? The bystander effect. You just, you know, try to ignore what's going on over there and not step in. But then there are characters of extreme moral fiber that do something extraordinary and that sort of lift the bar up for everybody, you know, like, you left the bar up for four people, you know. But I'm reading a book called All the Shining Things. It was co-authored by Hubert Dreyfus, who was like a Berkeley, very awesome dude. He wrote What Computers Can't Do and then What Computers Still Can't Do or something. This book, it's How to Find Meaning in a Secular Age. But he talks about this guy who, you may actually know the news story, but he jumped onto the rails. A guy had an epileptic fit in the subway tunnel and fell down onto the rails. And this guy jumped off the platform, had his two little girls with him, and jumped off the platform and got the guy in between the rails, and the subway passed over him, and he held him down, and they both came out unscathed, you know? And so, like, that guy, and he didn't, you know, he was one of those extreme moral characters, you know, extreme with extreme moral fiber or something like that, you know, like, and he affected, well, you know, that was picked up by the news and iterated and shown to thousands of people. And in particular, everybody on that platform watched him do that, you know? Yeah. And so I guess, like, you know, that is, so, you know, that idea of helping other people develop scripts through our actions. And I guess that's sort of, you know, that's what you're, what also the Christian calls being a witness or something, you know, like to be something to emulate Christ so that others can emulate you emulating Christ and so on and so forth. And I guess,
Well, I think, I mean, we should, Dallas Willard liked to emphasize the difference between training and trying. We might hear this idea and say, well, here's an ideal. I like that ideal. And I'd like to be the kind of person that did that. Well, you might not be able to be that kind of person right now. And the way you become that kind of person is usually you see something that you say, ooh, that's worthy of attaining for. So there's a lot of Jordan Peterson stuff in here. Mm-hmm. I'd like to be that kind of person. Okay, how do you become that kind of person? Maybe you're a kid and you grew up, and when you're 8 years old or 10 years old, the Olympics were on, and they come every 4 years. So, you know, when you're 10 years old and the Olympics come on, you've never seen the Olympics before. And you're watching downhill skiing, or you're watching swimming, or you're watching track and field, and you're like, wow, I wanna be able to do that. Okay, well, here's the good news. Maybe if you're, you know, living someplace like this, you can do this someday. Here's the bad news. It's going to take a lot of your life in order to be able to even try to be that fast or that good. And so I think about the civil rights movement, and it is not incidental that Dr. King was a pastor of churches, because what he leveraged in that movement was not just a bunch of idealistic youth, but what he leveraged was generations of church going, where people had been filled with a message that their master and their God was Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ, at the center of the story, lays down his life for his enemies. And so can we not see the relationship between these marchers of people? Yeah, they had ideas from Gandhi and Tolstoy, and they were able to take on these ideas, but they took on these ideas and they practiced them. And, you know, Dr. King and his nonviolence, I mean, if they saw that someone was really reactive, no, you can't march with us. Because we don't want to get into downtown and have you smashing windows, because that completely undermines our moral quality and our moral witness. That is not, you cannot be with us and do that. If you march with us, they will stick dogs on you. They will put fire hoses on you. They will call you names. They will say almost anything to trigger you. And they even trained for this. I mean, if you're going to sit at a lunch counter, you had to undergo training to demonstrate to each of them that you were not going to fight back. And that's how they won the war. Mm-hmm. Now there's a whole lot of stuff around that. And it worked with Gandhi in India. It worked with, I don't know that it would have worked in Nazi Germany. I don't know that it would have worked in the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. But the point is, if you want to be like Jesus, go into discipleship training of Jesus to become like Jesus. And you'd say, boy, I wonder if we had like a training program to be like Jesus, what would that involve? Well, we'd need like people to be around them, and we'd need people to read the primary sources, and those people might want a building so when it rained, they didn't get wet, and they were listening and practicing, and it might involve chanting, and maybe, boy, we chant better if we add a little bit of music to it. We'll call that singing. And, you know, if you start to think about this, there's a reason the church has developed. Now there's plenty of mess and distraction and you know, dead ends and wrong turns, and there's all of that too, But when you think about it, you think, how would that one man pouring 3 years into a group of disciples, how would he so dramatically change the world that when you're doing arguments with atheists, the truth is they've been so thoroughly colonized by Jesus in terms of a whole bunch of their moral presumptions, they don't even see it anymore. And when they're complaining about Christians not being loving or kind, well, you know, they probably have some points.
Yeah.
That's within a whole nother, and you could go through all the rest of it, but that's how thoroughly Jesus won.
Yeah.
And nobody recognizes it.
Yeah.
And so once you recognize it, well, you know, don't squander the winnings. Just let them argue that we should be nicer to gays and trans people, and let them understand that, you know, beating children and abusing them is, let them make that point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jesus made that point. Let them score Christian points. Yeah. And you don't have to face it. You don't have to point it out every time they do it, but let them.
Yeah.
And smile.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm right there with you in terms of, you know, letting him score, you know, Christian points, essentially, you know, like, because what C.S. Lewis had at this point about people don't really understand, like, the idea of, in some sense, like, best, better, worst, you know, like, he would talk about things like, yeah, I don't like this, but I really don't like this, so I would prefer that, you know, like, I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but, you know, like, I guess one would be like, you know, I really don't like violence or whatever, you know, I don't like people getting beat up in the streets, you know, like, and I would prefer our police didn't do that. But if there are people beating people up on the streets, I'd rather our police, you know, exercise violence to subdue a murderous criminal or something like that, you know? So stuff like, you know, stuff like that, where it's sort of like, yeah, I may not agree in whole, like wholesale with the ethos of, you know, a lot of my secular friends, but like I routinely have long conversations with my friend who studies political science, and he you know, like we're coming, and he's non-religious, like atheist, you know, and I'm deeply religious, you know, and so we you know, but we agree on loads and loads and loads of things, topics and conversation points and things like that, partly because, like, well, he's sort of like of the old guard in that sense, you know, like there are some people who are not completely like bought into that, the sort of the postmodern ideal, you know, like that where he still recognizes, like, for instance, he's read like Dostoevsky, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, like he reads legitimate, you know, books, and he doesn't get, you know, he doesn't like, he accepts that there are things that can be true and there are things that can be false. And like, coming from that sort of basis, like we disagree on some like fundamental things, but in terms of like acting out certain moral actions in the world or things that we think would be good, you know, to bring about, like he gets there, you know, boy, this is something that, it reminds me of, I think it's something Paul says, you know, some preach the gospel for vainglory, other for selfish desire. But I say glory to God, so long as the gospel is preached, by any means necessary, the gospel goes forward, something like that. You know, like it's something basically that, you know, like I don't really exactly what you're saying. It doesn't matter how you get to these sort of moral conclusions, that they go forward is to the glory of God in some sense, you know?
That's right. That's right. That's right. No, that's very true. And so, you know, we live in an amazing time. And, you know, I spent the first part of my career overseas as a foreign missionary in a very poor place, working with people who had far harder lives than you and I have. Mm. And we live in an amazing time with amazing liberties, amazing freedoms, amazing opportunities, amazing comforts. And yeah, is there stuff to be scared of? Absolutely. Could we lose all this? Yeah, we could blow it. Human beings do on a very regular basis. But you know, perhaps a little bit of gratitude for everything that we have. And in addition to that, an understanding that, you know, the benefits and the blessings we have were paid for by past generations and the sacrifices they made. So maybe a little bit of willingness to be able to sacrifice something. And that might be something as easy as somebody on another tribe making a point that you don't like. Okay. You made the point. Endure it. Take, you know, I taught a class a few years ago because on dealing with adult children. And I made the point in that class that is a point that it just about applies to almost everything. In almost everything, your ability to succeed is directly related to your ability to absorb a degree of pain. It's true for the little kid who watches the Olympics and says, I want to be a sprinter. Okay, you're going to have to absorb a lot of pain and suffering if you want to get that fast. And you may never get there because there's some genetics going on there too, probably at that level. You want to raise an adult child and you want to have a good relationship, you're going to have to learn to endure pain. Well, what kind of pain? Well, when they insult you, when they vote for a candidate that you think is evil, when they espouse and promote ideas and opinions, religious or political, or even in just other ways that you think are wrongheaded and are leading the world to catastrophe, you're going to have to decide, is now the right time to do what? To take away their agency? Few people respond well to that. So if you really want to, you know, think about someone who plays poker. How do you succeed at poker? You have a poker face. Well, what's a poker face? You lift up and you look at those cards and they're awful. And you don't say, you will lose at poker every time. Mm-hmm. What does it take to hold a poker face? You absorb pain. You don't flinch. Learn to absorb pain. And if you do, and again, the worst pains are the psychic pains. If you do, well, there's great power in that. Well, how will you use that power? So it's a life lesson.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's actually kind of a beautiful note to end on, really. Talking for a bit over an hour now. And I've enjoyed it. And I got so curious because I started to see more of these sort of, these like sort of debunking type people coming into your sphere of YouTube in that sense, you know, where like I thought that there were almost like non-overlapping areas of magisteria, you know, like there was like the Paul Vanderclays, the Jonathan Peugeots, the Vervaeke's over here. And then there's like the, you know, the Rationality Rules, Cosmic Skeptic, and like all these other guys over here acting in this other apologetic sphere. But then now they're starting to, in some sense, cross over maybe, or maybe they were always aware of.
Well, I do play a game and I will poke at Rationality Rules. I will poke at him sometimes. And that's why, you know, when Nathan decides to poke at me, that's part of the game. And that game is fun too. Yeah. I mean, I like playing that game. That can be fun. I've certainly played it enough, but there are deeper and subtler and more gratifying games. And in many ways, our lives are not games. We should treat each other with deadly seriousness. And of course, Lewis spoke, you know, wrote well about that in terms of, you know, if Christians believe what they say, their book says, and these other people are image bearers of God, and they ought to be treated that way. So, you know, I'll do some, and I'll play that game on Twitter sometimes. And usually it's, for me, it's an attempt to, well, let's have a deeper conversation. Let's have a better conversation, because I've done plenty of the other game. And again, I don't think there's anything wrong with that game. I think we learn from that game. But most of the learning is happening in the stands. And actually, most of the learning isn't even at the conscious level. It's sort of back in the, you know, back in the impressions level at other layers of our consciousness. But no, I hope these two worlds will come together, and we will, you know, I the thing is, if you're a celebrity atheist and you're deep in this game, you might not want to talk to me because to some degree your game depends on straw manning and putting a cut up, you know, this is what a Christian pastor looks like. And someone said, well, Paul doesn't look like that.
Yeah.
Look at all the hours of conversations he has with all of these people.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul and an atheist walk into a bar and they have a drink and they leave as friends. I got lots of atheist friends in my life. Yeah. And many Christians do. And many atheists have lots of Christian friends in their life. And so I think especially in times like these, if instead of just wanting to score points, and again, scoring, when I, if I play basketball, I want to run up the score. If I play cards, I want to win. But if I'm dealing with another human being, what are my marching orders from my master? Love your neighbor all the way up to and including your enemy. That's my match. Those are my matching orders from the one I say is my master. Okay. How am I going to do that? Well, that's hard. So that's what we do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, well, I mean, I think you do it well. And I agree. Like playing the game is a lot of fun. And well, playing the game in some sense, you know, well, what Nathan was playing the game and he got, was able to have this conversation with you and you became, you became human to him, you know? And so,
well, and, he and I had spoken before too.
Oh, okay. Okay.
If you go back in my channel, you'll find one or two conversations with him before.
I see.
So, you know, I'd first caught his attention. He'd first caught my attention. We had done his video about how I became a Christian because of Jordan Peterson. It's like, well, that's kind of in my little area.
Right,
so
right.
People were telling me about it. So I had a conversation with him and I'm not at all surprised that, you know, and so then when I talked to him again, I wanted to hear a story because you're on YouTube talking about how Jordan Peterson made you a Christian. Now you're on YouTube, you know, complaining about Christians. What happened? Right. I just want to hear the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I can, if you decide Christians are jerks and you hate them and you want to call me names, you go right ahead. I don't have a problem with that really. But I'd far rather just have a conversation with you. And, you know, in these weird relationships we have in the internet now, cause it's all a little different than in real life, but let's at least be able to talk with one another, because if we actually have a good faith conversation, I can learn more, because the truth is I know a lot about the shortcomings of Christianity and the church and Christians. I know a lot about it. I'm there all the time. So, but it's actually helpful for me to hear your opinion too. And I'm not threatened by that.
It kind of reminds me a little bit about G.K. Chesterton when he talks about having the hard conversation, when he says, you know, I could use 6, 7, 8 syllable words for an hour and a half and you won't see the slightest moving of the gray matter in my skull. But if I say Sally ought to hug her mother, like that, you know, that's a whole different ballpark. Like that, there's concretes involved. Like that's, you know, that's a difficult conversation to have. Like Sally needs to make up with her mother is much, you know, more, you know, that's more difficult to sort of wrestle with than sort of like the I don't even know what technical terms I could use, the hippocampus triggers on 6 or 7 firing lines and whatever. Like, you know, you could imagine a conversation in which you could say, attempt to say the same thing without having any really reaction in the person saying those things, you know? And I think in some sense, like, I don't think that's limited to, like, I don't think you can't use large words in conversations. That's not really the point I'm trying to make, really. Right. Rather that having a conversation one-on-one with you is a lot more meaningful and a lot more can happen than pulling up 10 quotes and dunking on, you know, fundamentalist evangelicals in, you know, the Southern United States or whatever, you know, like that I don't, you know, you can do that without the slightest twitching of your gray matter, you know, but like to sit down with Paul Vanderclay for an hour and a half, you know, I think that, you know, that, or, you know, Paul Vanderclay like figure, you know, like that gets you thinking, you know, like I've been told that Christians are dogmatic, evil people. And Well, I sat and talked with Paul for, you know, Oh, sure. Yeah. You know, yeah. Sometimes they're manipulative.
Catch me being
sometimes
Don Mackin evil.
Yeah.
My wife catches me doing that all the time.
Yeah. True. Fair enough. Yeah.
And she can lean on me in ways you'll never be able to.
Yeah.
So, that's just the way life works.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, I mean, I've really enjoyed our conversation. I don't know if you had any other points to make.
No, this has been wonderful.
Thanks for taking the time to watch this episode of Will Work for Purpose. If you found anything here interesting, you can always leave a comment below or email me at mosley@tweakingo.com. If you were watching this podcast on YouTube, you can find audio versions of it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else major podcasts are found. So thanks for watching, and we'll see you in the next one.